H.G. Morrison, Imperial War Museum, accession number 11585/3, Reel 2.
Mr. Morrison, Reel 2.
Good. Referring to need to know on Reel 1, another example is that I was asked to attend meetings at a house in St. James Square, London. I was told not to say anything unless I was asked a direct question. I went over a period of some weeks, a good many times, and never opened my mouth. It was only very much later that I was told I was attending a planning committee meeting or series of meetings connected with Overlord or the invasion. Usually, when going to any site of a crashed aircraft, I travelled in my own car as public transport, to begin with, was nearly non-existent, and aircraft invariably fell miles from any possible public transport. But there were one or two occasions when the distances were so great that I would have to borrow an aeroplane. And on one particular occasion, I had to fly up to RAF Dice near Aberdeen, where I understood an intact German bomber had landed. Fortunately, our fighter patrols had concluded that he wished to come in to Dice. And instead of shooting him down, which would have been a complete disaster, he was escorted in, and the aircraft promptly hidden away in a hangar. It so happened that it was the very latest night fighter, which gave Professor Jones, whom I have already mentioned, any number of answers, including the fact that these aircraft were able to home in on our bombers with the greatest of ease if our own aircraft left switched on an instrument known as IFF, or identification, friend or foe. We had in fact heard rumours about this in the intelligence world and had advised Bomber Command to tell its crews on no account to leave IFF on once they had left these shores on a mission. Unfortunately, some crews did not believe this information and considered that they were protecting themselves despite anything we said. Once Professor Jones had proved that they were making themselves a sitting target, I believe the practice did cease. Now, this aeroplane was so interesting that once again I had to send back to Air Ministry for our wireless expert. And he was flown up in a Mosquito, whereas I had to come in a very much slower aeroplane and was told to return by night train, so that I was very jealous of him.
What kind of a German night fighter was it?
Oh, it was the very latest Junkers 88. Referring to aircraft which appeared to be wishing to surrender, we had a similar occasion at RAF Manston in Kent, where a Focke-Wulf 190 said that as he had been in combat, he thought he was flying towards France, but in fact he was on a complete reciprocal course and landed perfectly at Manston, where again he was immediately arrested and the aircraft quickly hidden in a hangar. This brings me to mention that it was fairly rare to have such a marvelous capture as these two aircraft, but there were one or two others, so that in the end we had an ME-109, an ME-110, and a Heinkel 111 in addition to these two machines just mentioned. They were formed into what was called the Flying Circus, which I took control of for a period of several months. We visited operational RAF stations to demonstrate how good these aircraft were, as many of our pilots were believing rumors that the Germans were no longer capable of making a first-class machine. Our first port of call was to RAF Thamesford, and I should point out that the program was arranged by Air Ministry without consultation to our small with our small department. When we arrived at Thamesford, I had a very frosty reception from the station commander, who wanted to know what on earth we were doing bringing German aircraft in to his airfield. When I explained that we were going to give a demonstration of their capabilities, I was told to go away in no uncertain terms. I asked the reason why we had such a bad reception. He said, "Don't you know that this is the airfield from which we fly our spies, and we certainly don't want people seeing German aircraft around here?"
Who was in this flying circuit apart from yourself?
Probably some of the best pilots in the RAF. And of course we could not move about the country without informing anti-aircraft command or without a fighter escort, as the German planes were naturally in their proper colours. But Thamesford was the only one where the security was a bit silly. However,
do you remember the names of any of the pilots who flew the German planes in this flying circus?
Well, it seems rather silly of me, but at this distance, the answer is no, I don't. I'm sorry to say.
How many were there? Just two or three?
No, we had one. We flew as a circus, so we had one, obviously one pilot for every aircraft we were flying. But I don't recollect having what you might call reserve pilots. I think they stuck with us throughout the tours.
Do you think the RAF pilots learned a great deal from these, looking at these German aircraft?
Well, we hope they did. And the reason is that very early on I was flying in the Heinkel 111, a thing which I, after this particular occasion, I never did again. We were flying from RAF Waddington and were going to be attacked by fighters from a nearby station, RAF Digby. I was looking, so far as one could look with any ease, backwards out of this aircraft when I saw two fighters approaching. And I turned to our pilot and said, for heaven's sake, take evasive action. I think they're really going to ram us. Instead of that, they hit one another, and of course both pilots were killed. Once again, I got the blame. And I explained to the station commander at Waddington that at least the pilot from RAF Digby now realized that they were up against excellent aeroplanes. It happened only twice again when fighters deliberately were trying to attack the Ju-88, which easily outturned them, and they went into high-speed stalls, that is the British aircraft, and of course crashed. So we hope that despite these unfortunate accidents, the word did get around our operational stations that the Germans still were highly dangerous enemies.
Were the RAF pilots at the stations allowed to fly the German planes?
No. No, the only people who flew them, apart from the pilots attached, of course, to the circus, were, well, certainly pilots and I imagine civilians at the Royal Aircraft Establishment Farnborough. All this time, I have been talking about RAF intelligence, but every time an enemy aircraft crashed, or indeed if something fell off an aeroplane, be it enemy or our own, the local police were involved, and they were quite magnificent. If the crew were badly if the crew, for instance, were badly mutilated but also killed, enormous trouble was taken to recover every fragment of a body for a proper Christian burial. Also, they never forgot that if something fell from the air, it should come to what by this time had changed his name to ADI Science, Assistant Director of Intelligence Science. And one day I received a little suitcase from Aberdeen. Upon opening it, it had a wireless set inside. And I thought to myself, if the police have found this, where is the chap who was carrying it when he was dropped out of an aircraft? So I contacted, for the first and only time, MI5 and said that I had a little surprise for them, which I would deliver if they would promise to answer one of my questions. So, metaphorically carrying this suitcase behind my back, I had an interview with MI5, and I said, I've got something which dropped from the air, but what happened to the spy who was carrying it? And the answer was, we were waiting for him, but we could never find the suitcase. So it was one up to the local copper. As the Allied forces gradually moved through Europe, of course the aerial attacks on this country diminished and, of course, eventually petered out. But the flow of technical information was absolutely enormous, and it all arrived in our office. As I mentioned much earlier on, speaking the language and being one of the few in this department who could do so, I then appeared to spend as many hours in the day as I could stay awake, reading through the material, translating it into English, and where appropriate, taking the original documents down to the Royal Aircraft Establishment. These documents, in fact, were not at Air Ministry proper, but at a small house which the department occupied out near Bentley Priory, which was the headquarters of Fighter Command. And I found that by 6 o'clock or so in the evening, I really had to stop for a bit. So I would drive up to Bentley Priory, walk into the officers' mess, and ask for a large gin and tonic. Unfortunately, Bentley Priory seemed to be rather rationed for spirits of that nature, and the barman used to point out to me, if I asked for a third large gin, that I was only a visiting officer.
I noticed that on the form that you filled out, that you've written down that your Rushford department,
yes,
was changed its number from AI1G to AI2G. Is there any significance in that?
I don't think any of us ever knew why.
Also, you said that...
And then we became ADI Science. Again, I think there must have been several servants who've got nothing better to do but change names, like they change the names of counties today. I mean, there must have been some administrative reason for doing it, but what on earth it was, it didn't make any difference of our work anyway.
You've also said that in 1945 you went to Germany for 3 weeks. Was that to gather more information on the spot?
Yes. Anything that... Well, the area was so vast, of course, and we only had a couple of chaps, I think I'm right in saying. following basically the British, but I got sent off and I had to go into the American zone. Okay. Having worn RAF blue all the war, I was a little upset when advised that I should wear khaki battle dress, and I refused to do so. The advice, in fact, was good, because not very far from Frankfurt on the River Main, I had commandeered a car and a chauffeur and was talking to him in German when we were stopped by an American private who pointed his rifle at me and called me a bloody kraut. I disabused him and said that unless he could learn the difference between a member of His Majesty's Royal Air Force and a member of the Luftwaffe, I would report him to General Patton, which seemed to persuade him that in fact I was a British officer. Without wishing to denigrate our American allies, I did sometimes laugh a little bit. And another instance being a few days later, approaching Heidelberg, where I thought there would be some interesting information available, I asked an American soldier where the officer's mess was. And he replied, "The general's mess is right up there." So thinking that I wasn't a general, I wondered if I should try to brazen it out. So I approached the general's mess and I was welcomed by the staff there as, "Good morning, general." Even the American generals appeared to take me for one of their own rank, and I was invited to dine and to stay the night. But I forbore to point out that in their terms, I was but a major.
You're a squadron leader.
Yeah.
Did you find out very much from your visit to Germany in the way of intelligence?
Now then, how much did I find out? I brought back certainly documents which had not come via the previous route. And indeed, I found drawings of aircraft which were only in the planning stage, which were, again, of great interest to the Royal Aircraft Establishment. I think the trip was probably worthwhile, but I did find that I was competing with American civilians even such a short time after VE Day. They were all there trying to secure benefits for their civilian firms. And Britain most certainly was not represented in that way at all, so far as I could establish.
Did you ever have anything to do with the German jets, which they got into the air before the end of the war?
Yes, with the ME-262, we knew quite a lot about them. In fact, I am almost certain that one was flown over after the war ended to the Royal Aircraft Establishment. We also knew a certain amount about their rocket-propelled interceptor fighter known as the ME-163, which, on the whole, was a pretty useless weapon in that it could climb, because of its rocket propulsion, at an enormous speed and to a very great height. But by then, the fuel had run out and it turned into virtually a glider. So the only hope it had was to be able to steer itself into a position to fire its rocket and then land, hopefully without killing its pilot. Not, I would have thought, a very successful weapon for the enormous amount that must have been spent on its research and construction.
I think you remember the first V2 landing, and I think you said that you were rather annoyed about the security aspect of it.
Yes, we obviously didn't want the Germans to know where it had landed because they weren't any too sure at that stage of the accuracy of its navigational system. However, later that evening, the Ministry of Home Security broadcast a message to the British public, of course, but immediately picked up by the German intelligence networks, that a gas main had exploded in Hammersmith, which gave the exact answer that the Germans wanted. They knew perfectly well that as the gas main blew up at the estimated time of arrival of their rocket, that was where it had hit. What can you do with people who really do not understand secrecy? And again, with the first of the V1s, the flying bombs, four of them landed in a field in Kent, in fact in an orchard, and I suppose I wrote the stupidest report I ever had done when I said that it was a useless weapon, it couldn't hurt a fly. And the reason was the fuses were so sensitive that landing in open ground, the crater was only a matter of 2 to 3 feet deep, and the trees within 50 yards of it didn't even lose leaves. I very quickly regretted having written that when the later ones started falling in places like Greenwich and blowing rows of houses to pieces as though they were packs of cards.
You were telling me earlier that you were the technical advisor to the people conducting the black propaganda.
That's right. Well, the gentleman in charge of it was a very brilliant journalist. And like so many brilliant journalists, he was not technically minded. And therefore his fertile imagination was inclined to invent German aircraft, which really did not exist. But as we transmitted, as though we were a German station, we could not afford to make the slightest mistakes which would have alerted the German forces to the origin of these messages. And in fact, on one particular occasion, which I clearly remember, we knew a raid coming across the North Sea was probably bound for Glasgow. And so we broadcast a message saying that their meteorological officer had inadvertently made a mistake when he told them that the cloud base approaching Scotland was 500 metres, and he really meant 1,500 metres. So there was no reason why they shouldn't come down to fly below a cloud. Well, of course, the meteorological officer had not made a mistake, and they flew a whole lot of them straight into the Scottish Hills.